This is September 12th, 2010. And there is a synchronicity of events this past week that pretty much determined the topic I would choose for Taisho today. Yesterday was September 11th. Don't even need to tell anyone the significance of that. There is controversy, the bitter controversy over the building of the mosque in near Ground Zero goes on. There is this hysteria about the pastor in Florida who wanted to burn the Quran yesterday, but then I guess didn't. Where the last week ended Ramadan. We had this weekend Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. So I want to talk about religion, freedom of religion, politics, fear, paranoia, and how the media, how the media is in the middle of all of this. I won't claim that this will be the most organized Taisho, but I'm just going to wade into this and maybe try to offer a perspective on what can be enormously emotional, provocative time. Someone said that we seem to be living in an era of fear in so many forms of fear, from parents' fear for their children to be out without them anywhere, even in the neighborhood, to much larger scale fear of Islamic jihad and Muslims in general. I'm going to start by offering some thoughts about the building of the mosque in Manhattan. I don't think anyone would argue that this imam and his congregation don't have a right to build the mosque there, two blocks from Ground Zero. I think that's well established. They have every right to. But the real issue seems to be the private pain of those families of the victims of 9/11, weighing their private pain and their with the constitutional right of the mosque to be the congregation to build their mosque there. You can see both sides, can't you? I think any reasonable person could certainly appreciate what a sensitive issue it is to build a mosque so close to Ground Zero, because so many people just conflate Islam in general with the fanatical, militaristic, militant jihadists, Wahhabis. And so there's the image, the faulty image of Islam as being a religion of terrorism, and to the degree that you buy into that, then it will certainly seem like an affront to have the mosque built there. And of course, just the human sympathy for those who lost family members there, and the rawness, even 9 years later, the rawness of that grief, and often anger as well. The argument to build it is that this imam does have a pretty strong track record of moderation and mediation and strong value of peace. He's been there. He has a mosque about 10 blocks from his current mosque. He's about 10 blocks from Ground Zero. He's been there for 30 years, and there is no evidence at all that he has anything but peaceful intentions. That is, that he supports anything but the nobler values of Islam. So by allowing him and his congregation to build this cultural center, which includes a mosque, it's not just a mosque, to build this would seem to be to support moderate Muslims. There has been, ever since 9/11, there have been many who have said what we need is to hear the voices of moderate Muslims, the non-militant Muslims, Muslims who uphold and are actively working for the universal religious values of peace and brotherhood and so forth. In fact, that's, I think, a valid criticism is for years were that so few Muslim leaders, imams and other leaders, spoke out against militant Islam. Well, here's one who has. Here's one who has a long, long record of working very, very diligently peace and religious dialogue across all religions, and let's support him. Let's support that voice and have him continue what seems to be good work. One could argue that as terrible as the private pain of the families of the victims of 9/11, as terrible as that is, and as deeply as we can sympathize with them, should that trump, pun intended, should that trump the right guaranteed by our Constitution for a cultural center and mosque to be built there, especially since their intentions seem to be very good. His wife was interviewed. He was out of the country or something, and she said, "Our intention is to provide a counter momentum against extremism." This would be a wonderful thing if that could actually happen. So they have the right to build a mosque there, guaranteed by the Constitution, and there, it's a very strong argument that they should, for the greater good, be allowed to have a big center for peace and interfaith dialogue there. Whether this is the time, I guess, is the question. I put myself in his position. I think of when we set about planning to build our retreat center at Chapin Mill. Whether if there had been strong opposition by our neighbors in Batavia and Stafford, the people of the community there, whether even out of complete ignorance and prejudice and fear, if there had been opposition to it, at what point does it make sense to just yield to the reality of the situation? And I'm sure that this imam and his followers anticipated that there would be some outcry, some opposition to their building. Maybe what they thought was that, yes, there will be an uproar, but it'll eventually pass, and then they could get about the good work that they hope to do there. It's a very touchy situation. We don't know how long this is going to go on. I heard recently that, I don't remember who it was, someone who was against the building of the mosque said that he said, I trust that there will be construction workers patriotic enough to be sure that this mosque, if it comes about to be built, that it would collapse before anyone occupied it. In other words, suggesting that there would be ways for anti-Muslim construction workers to sabotage the stability of the building. Someone else commented, well, at least this guy who said this added the phrase before it's occupied. But at what point do you surrender even to what may be the most ill-informed, prejudiced opposition, if ever? I mean, just from a practical standpoint, this imam and his followers really are incurring a risk by proceeding with this if the opposition is fierce enough and long-standing enough. A phrase came into my mind. In thinking about how this imam and his followers are going to proceed now, it came out of a doksan that I went to in Japan when I was there 25 years ago. I was training at Sogenji Temple there in Okayama, and I had taken a new practice. It wasn't a koan. It was a practice that at one day I was feeling kind of frustrated with it. And I went to the Roshi in Doksan, and I explained how I felt sort of at an impasse despite all my efforts, you know, hours of sitting a day and at night and all that. I felt I was just sort of stymied. And in his very limited English, he had enough English to say this. He said, well, we have a saying, if you can't push, pull. And it helped. It was the right words at the right time. What I took from that was there's a place to stop trying to force an issue and find a different way of working. And that may mean a kind of surrender. Now, surrender is a word that can mean different things. It can mean a kind of failure, at least a temporary failure, or it can mean an intelligent yielding or becoming more flexible. In recognition that what one has been doing, the way one has been working, hasn't been effective and may very well not be effective for a long time to come. we have the privilege of not being closely involved in this. None of us is that imam. None of us are leaders in that community where we have to make a decision as to whether to keep the pressure on, keep advocating for the building of the mosque, or backing off. But it is part of working with reality. I mean, that's what we're doing in Zen practice. We're learning how to work with frustration. That's one thing. Working with frustration, how to manage our efforts. I could never articulate exactly what this means in terms of Zazen, but there is a time to find another way to work, and there's a time to accept that conditions aren't suitable at this moment to accomplish what we want to accomplish, and there's a time for patience and forbearance and waiting until conditions change. I read somewhere that this imam is actually a Sufi in the Sufi school of Islam. I think Sufism is sort of the Zen equivalent to Islam. Zen has often been called the mystical school of Buddhism, mystical in that it emphasizes the meditation, contemplation, and the Sufi school is the one in Islam that emphasizes the contemplative, or the experience, direct experience through meditation and dance. I think the Sufism has a long tradition of peacefulness, of not getting engaged with forces of opposition and certainly not militancy. So he seems to be a pretty good man, not just by the little we can see in TV and photographs in the printed media, but his record, again, his 30 years there in New York. But what do we really know about all of this? What do we know about anything? Most of what we know that's beyond our immediate sphere of experience, is through the media. I've mentioned this elsewhere in Taisho, but I think it's worth repeating that we are so captive to the media in terms of knowing facts that are beyond our immediate environment, our direct experience. There is a great deal of exploitation of this issue on the part of politicians, especially politicians who have learned that you can win elections by fanning the flames of fear on the part of voters. There's a new phrase that has entered the political lexicon: stealth jihad. I'm reading from a column here in Newsweek for September 6th by Lisa Miller. Newt Gingrich used this term, stealth jihad. and define it as an effort to replace Western civilization with a radical imposition of Sharia. Sharia is the ancient Muslim system of justice that includes, well, I better stop talking about it. I don't know enough about it, but it's often associated in the media with stoning of adulterers, stoning them to death, and cutting off limbs for crime, theft, and things like this, and other things that strike many of us as barbaric. She says, this Lisa Miller says, the only thing scarier than an invisible, homicidal, suicidal enemy with a taste for world domination is one who's sneaking up on you. And for people who tend to react to foreignness with fear, this is going to have quite an effect, this term, radical, or stealth jihad. She compares it to some of the devices used during the McCarthy era. Many of us were disappointed with President Obama's seeming to back off after saying that they have a right to build this mosque there, then sort of muddying it by saying, making the point that they have the right, but he said they have the right, but he didn't say they should build it. Well, you know, Obama's a politician, let's face it, and he's facing a very formidable poll numbers in the fall election, so it would certainly be understandable if he was trying to hedge things and obfuscate in order not to alienate voters, any voters. But I think it's a useful distinction to make. Of course they have the right, make that clear, but whether they should, I don't know. I'm not going to say whether they should or shouldn't, because what would that be based on? We're too far from all of the complexities of it. Even here, it's in our own state. But what do we really know? And this gets us back to this matter of what we base decisions on, what we base opinions on, or positions on. And again, we're stuck with media. There was a book in the 70s called Four Arguments for the Elimination of Television. It made some very compelling arguments. It was an unfortunate title. Roshi Kaplan and I both thought it never got the attention it deserved because it's about much more than television. I mean, the idea of eliminating television, of course, is utterly quixotic, idealistic notion. We're not going to eliminate television. But it sounds like one of those titles that the publishers had the final say on in order to stimulate sales. People grab people's attention in the bookstores and get them to buy the book. But it was a very thoughtful and informed book about, really, the book is about our mediated environment. How much of our of what we hear and see about the world beyond our immediate sense experience, how much of it is mediated by electronic media and other media. This was before personal computers and the internet became really popular. Even then, it was easy to see how It's newspapers, magazines, TV, and radio that we have to go on. And now it's the internet, which is even more dangerous because anyone, anywhere, can say anything they want on the internet. And it's well to remain ever aware that the media can have its own agenda, and it has to attract viewers and listeners and readers to stay alive, to stay financially solvent. And how do you... He makes the point, in the case of TV, that TV really thrives on conflict. He even says there, I was looking for the book, I couldn't find it last night, he even says there that a nature-based tradition like Zen, it's an interesting way to categorize it, but anyway, that a tradition such as Zen, let's say, cannot be portrayed by TV because, there's no conflict to show, and it's too subtle to hold viewers, the principles of it. And what are you going to show, people sitting facing a wall? Actually, there are, you know, TV stations that have wanted to do that. We've been approached, not often, but over the years, by reporters from TV, local TV, who asked if they could film us sitting. How long do you think that would hold viewers? You'd have to bring in the stick. Come on, you know. And then that would be provocative. So we did it once or twice. We had a reporter following us around for like a couple days, and a camera some of that time. And it just it has never seemed to evoke anyone interested enough, serious enough to come here. So I just decline now when we get those requests. And knowing also that the editors have so much power about how it's portrayed, we all know this, whether it's TV or newspapers, magazines, there's nothing more disillusioning about the media than having a story written about something you're close to, you really know about, you're informed about, and you read it, you know, you're excited, you spend time with a reporter going over it all and trying to make it simple enough that it they can use it, and then you read it and it's just a disappointment how superficial and often distorted it is. So if it happens about subjects that we're close to, then we can be, it has to undermine our faith in what we read and see and hear in the media. It's a real dilemma. Living in a democracy means being informed, staying informed. But what is informed when what we have to rely on is so often colored by financial and profit-making motives and political slants. There was an article that appeared in the New York Times this past week about how the media fanned this elevated this pastor in Florida who wanted to do a Quran burning yesterday, how they elevated his importance over this week or two. This pastor, Terry Jones, said he consented to more than 150 interview requests in July and August, each time expressing his extremist views about Islam and Sharia law. This is the author of this New York Times article is Brian Stelter. It's called Coverage of Koran Case Stirs Questions on Media Role. And I just marked a couple things here. He says, in some ways, this week's events were the culmination of a year's worth of hateful statements and stunts by Mr. Jones and a few dozen members of his church. It reports that he started to make noise about all this a year ago and posted a sign outside his church that read, Islam is of the devil. And then that really ignited all this controversy. And then some of the well-known public figures, politicians, and news people who were very happy to fan the flames of hate around the mosque building of the mosque in Manhattan were silent about when asked, "What about this? Do you think that we should have this burning of the Quran?" It's such a horrible mix of politics and greed and hate and prejudice that can be put together these days that affects so many people. From a Zen perspective, the underlying problem always is the danger of abstractions, the danger of notions, the danger of ideas. And in this case, in all of this business, the most treacherous notion is that of us versus them, the other, the menacing other, whether it's Muslims or blacks or Buddhists or Jews. Other, not self, not us. In another article I read that more and more Americans now believe that Obama is a Muslim. According to some recent poll, a quarter of Americans believe he's a Muslim, and 43% of Republicans believe he's a Muslim. I don't believe he's a Muslim, but how do we know? What do we have to rely on? Have we talked to him? Who's talked to him? Who's Again, we're stuck with the media, what we read. Yes, okay. Since it's all we have to go on, other than our own direct experience of what's around us, we can read things, we can learn what's reliable, what's not reliable in the media. But who knows and who cares? What does it matter what his religion is? Unless you divide the world into us and them. My religion, my faith, my worldview, and their faith, their religion. That's the abstraction. Us versus them. In Zen, our responsibility, one of our key responsibilities, is to not get caught in words, to learn to see through words. For centuries, Zen has been called teaching beyond words. So there's that. There's something, an ongoing project for all of us. Is to be able to discern when an anchor person or a reporter or anyone is manipulating words to shape us, shape our thinking, to be able to discern the true from the false in words. That just comes with time. We get better at it. And there's also recognizing that underneath hate, and there is so much hate and anger that is being unleashed these days, this year, underneath hate is fear. And it does help. I find it helps to, when you see people and hear about people who are tantruming and spewing hatred about other religions and other political parties, to remind yourself, if you can believe this, that underneath that is fear. And what's the fear? It's better to look at the fear than with the words of hatred. And it can mollify one's own tendency to react to these people. I mean, this, look at the changes in our world in the last 10, 20 years. It's staggering, huge, deep, fundamental changes in the world and the way we can know the world. This change is frightening to human beings. And we've learned from history that it's all the more frightening when you're in a recession. You've been, especially if you're unemployed, you don't know how you're going to support your family, yourself maybe. Your future is uncertain, is menacing. The tendency then, more than ever, is to find a scapegoat. In the 30s, Hitler found the Jews. And now, more than ever, people are finding the Muslims to hate and to blame. Always in Zen practice, our job is to notice what's going on in the mind. That's what carries out beyond the Zendo. Sure, in the Zendo we have to notice when our mind has wandered and bring it back to the practice. But that's just to train us in noticing what's going on in our mind all the time. When we're outside the Zendo, when we're watching TV or reading blogs on the internet or hearing things on the radio, is to notice our tendency to react to people, to notice the fears, to notice the way that we blindly tend to categorize people and lump people together. So it all comes down to Zazen, to the sitting and to the extension of the sitting by being present in order to see how we are forming our opinions, how we are reacting, how our perceptions are colored by thoughts, deep-seated, not just little thoughts that flit through the mind, but deep-seated stains of the mind, conditioning, old conditioning, racial, ethnic, religious conditioning, and to just notice it. And noticing it is more than half the battle. Once we have that meta-awareness, we can step back and see the way the mind is working, then we can avoid being captivated, being made captive by these tendencies of prejudice and ignorance and fear. Okay, time is up. Let's stop and recite the four vows.